I'm Amy.
I'm Wendell.
And I'm Patrick.
And
this is
Yes
But Why
Podcast.
Wanted to tell you this, but I wanted to hit record before I did so that, you know, we could start talking about improv.
Yeah.
I started reading this book. It is called If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face by Alan Alda. And Alan Alda was in, like, the first improv group, like the group called The Committee in California. And the people who were in that troupe with him went on to move to Chicago and start, like, Second City.
Oh, wow.
And so this was, like, the beginnings before we get to Second City and all the other stuff, before Del Close is involved in it. These are the people that are working on it. So it's really interesting to hear him. So he writes this book about how he is using improv exercises to teach scientists how to communicate, because they're... you know, brain is such that they're great at figuring out the science, but they're not so great at telling a person who's needs to give them funding why they need to give them funding, or any level of, like, this is why what I do is cool. They're just like, it's necessary. And you're like, okay, but sell it a little. So he goes through, like, how he developed his... So he teaches a program at Stony Brook University, and he goes through the whole thing explaining, like, how he got the idea, how it started, what the findings... And he throughout the whole thing, he's like, this is anecdotal. This is just what I found. But it's really interesting to listen to somebody talk about improv in a way that's so, like, this is how you can really help the world.
Oh, I mean, I personally totally relate to this because I'm naturally left-brained, so I'm flipping through this book wondering where I'm going to get it or if I'm going to borrow this when you're done.
Yeah.
Because that's something I've had to learn, and that's why I've loved improv, is because I'm naturally a science-brained, assuming everybody understands everything that's going on in my head.
Interesting.
Yeah. But this looks awesome.
Oh, that's fun. So given that that's how you diagnose yourself, do you find that when you started doing improv that you had trouble with the part of sort of group mind of connecting with the person? Because you assume that they know what's in your brain, and they probably don't, because we all are thinking our own thoughts. Did you hit a lot of walls when it came to communication in that way?
You know, I played team sports growing up, so I was used to doing what it took for the benefit of a group. But I think what I found difficult was that improv is full of different kinds of artists with different kinds of ideas, and our ideas weren't all on the same page all the time. And I found that challenging. The idea of having to kind of listen to what other people were saying, as terrible as it sounds, was hard for me, because sometimes in my head, I had a good idea and I wanted to get it out and I wanted to play with it.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, that was, for me, that was the hardest part of level one. And honestly, just being comfortable opening up. I think even in industry, improv is amazing for anyone, anywhere, because being able to open up and be vulnerable in any capacity at anywhere is very difficult. And I found that hard in level one. Because you know, you don't want to look like an asshole in front of all these strangers.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean,
absolutely.
Anything that comes out your mouth, there's a very good chance you're going to fail at what you're saying.
Yeah.
But I found by level three and four, like, it was pretty predictable that everyone was going to support what you were going to say, and that's for me when it started getting a little bit easier.
Yeah. I find that when I teach level one, I have to put the syrup on a bit more than other times. You know, it's like, come on, we're going to be the sweetest to each other. Mm-hmm. We're like the bestest of friends. Like, they've just met, you know, this is their second class, and I'm all like, we're going to be so close.
Yeah, but you have that infectious energy. If you were my level one teacher, I feel like all my walls would come down immediately. But I'm curious, what do you find the most commonly difficult thing to get people to open up with an improv in level one? Like, what is a challenge that comes up for you?
I personally think that I open the floodgates of ideas in their head, and then it goes too wild, which is good, because that's a good problem to have. But something that'll happen, I rarely have students that don't talk. I will tell them they should talk so much that they're adding 47,000 details to a scene, and I have to go, okay, cool. One of those was cool. Didn't have to have, you know, you didn't have to be a doctor that did hearts and brains and also hair and also science and also you're going to Mars. That's a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just one, just worry about juggling one thing at a time. So I feel like really, I get a lot of people who are overly contributing, mm-hmm. and I have to help them hone what the both the funniest ideas are, and then not only like how to see that because it's such a subjective thing,
mm-hmm.
But also like how to just keep it simple, because I think we do that all to ourselves, like in life. You know, we bite off more than we can chew a ton. Mm-hmm. We'll say yes to too many things, especially people who are likely to take an improv class. Like, mm-hmm. one thing that I generally do at the beginning of my improv class is to say, I want everyone to stop worrying that they're not cool. No one takes an improv class that isn't a little funny already. Like, nobody's... You took this class because your cube mate told you you were funny. Your brother told you you were funny. Mm-hmm. Your the waiter at the restaurant told you you were funny. Somebody told you you were funny, and you thought, what can I do with that? And then you found an improv class. Like, that's how everyone gets through the door. So we're all together. We're funny people. It's cool. We don't have to worry about that part. Let's now dig into this, like, brain thing, mm-hmm. that we're gonna do, which is exercise ideas and then just try to talk them out with each other.
Right.
And so I think that eases people, because it's like, no, we're all the same. Like, mm-hmm. we're not at a meeting of something where we don't have, this is the one thing we all have in common.
Mm-hmm.
Like, somebody in our life has said, you're the funniest.
You know, that's funny. I was trying to think, how did I get into improv? And somebody randomly at a Jewish community fundraiser said, you're funny, you should take this class. And I took it. That is how I ended up at the New Movement.
Yeah. I mean, that's how everybody takes the class. And you don't look up how to take comedy classes unless, A, you are already dedicated to be a comedian without anyone telling you,
mm-hmm.
or somebody mentioned it to you. I mean, why would a person take a comedy class? Like, I've had people who've said, my boss told me I should, but that's just another version of somebody told me I was funny.
What if it's on Groupon too? That's a double reason to just take it. That was the what happened to me. I was told I was funny. I said, all right, let me find where I can do these classes. And I saw there's a Groupon for it. And that sealed the deal.
Yeah. No, it did for a long time with a lot of people, actually. I feel like a huge portion of people made it in through the Groupon for sure. But I mean, even with a Groupon, I would get people... Here's the thing about Groupon. This is interesting. At least from my point of view, when I ran the school, we don't get a list of all the people. Like, Groupon doesn't send you a list of people that bought your thing. Or if they do, I didn't get it. Whoever got it didn't send it to me. And so I never knew who bought the Groupon. I only knew the people who, after receiving the Groupon, then got in contact with us. Because they get the thing, and mm-hmm. it says, contact this thing to enroll in a class. And then you do, and that's it. But you have to take that second step.
Mm-hmm.
Many, many, many people just take the first step.
Oh, I couldn't... I couldn't figure out to save my life. Half the time I buy Groupons, and I don't end up using them, because I have no idea how to get registered to the thing, or... I showed up to a Broadway show once, and apparently you had to register for a thing, and I was all dressed up and ready to see a Broadway show, and I hadn't emailed whatever the email was.
Yeah. I mean, well, they don't make it easy, but they also, like, to a certain extent, I feel like it's almost like hoops you have to jump through. It's like, how badly do you want this deal?
And it weans out, what do they call it? It trims the fat.
Yeah.
We got rid of all the dumbasses through the intricate process of getting through the Groupon process.
Yeah, well, and when you think about a comedy class, I think it weeds out the fearful.
Mm-hmm.
If they were brave in that 1 second when they hit buy, and then when it got to them, they were like, no, thank mm-hmm. you. The nice thing that I always say is, thank you for donating. Like, you just donated money to this theater, and we really appreciate it.
I'm a firm believer in natural selection. That is absolutely natural selection and action.
Not to mention the fact that, truly, I've taught hundreds of level ones, and the class will not be the final class until maybe class 3 or 4.
Mm-hmm.
There's always a huge amount, except for with your class.
Yeah, gained people. Yeah. We got 2 as we went.
Yeah, absolutely.
God, no. That was, 14 people or something like that?
Absolutely. Yeah, you had like 14, there were 2 14-person classes going at the same time, right at the same moment. It was wild for that many
people. Well, we
weren't
just 14. We were like 12 loud people and then 2 normal people who like had loud tendencies. I remember our level, it was a level 4 or level 5 show, it basically was a screaming match. And I remember after, I was asking my husband what he thought about our scenes, and he was like, I don't really know what happened, but you guys were laughing, so I laughed.
You know, sometimes I think about that with reference to performance of improv, that it's like, it's actually more fun for the performer than the audience.
Oh, 100%.
Because you are in on this magical journey of, I don't know what's going to happen, mm-hmm. and you're just trying to keep your head above water enough to continue to speak until the lights go down. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a wild ride, you know, that rivals, you know, any roller coaster to be on stage doing improv, because it's so like, I don't know, I'm just going to keep trying and wing it.
Well, that was something that was hard for me, was I'm an ENTP or an ENTJ brain type. I'm very left brained. And so I naturally want to please the audience. So the whole time I'm on this fun roller coaster, having a blast, but I always look out at the audience, and if they don't look happy, every ounce of fun is immediately sucked from my body. So it's been this weird balance I've had to figure out.
Yeah.
Because all the time you have those shows where, you know, you sang that crazy number, or you had that scene that went to space and you thought it was grounded, and you're laughing and you look out and just a bunch of blank faces. In fact, a couple weeks ago, I was actually in a show where I looked out and I felt okay about things. I try not to look at the audience too much in shows.
Mm-hmm.
And this one guy was asleep in the front row. And that was a show that I thought was going pretty good. And then I tried to tell myself, like, well, maybe it's just him. And so then I looked to the right side, and there's 2 people on their cell phones. But those happen. I mean, that's an important part of improv, is figuring out, like, what can I do to keep these people engaged? When we're having a bad day, what can we do to at least hit the minimum that an audience wants to see and feel like, you know, what they've paid for their ticket is at least being delivered?
Yeah. Sometimes I worry that the formats are there for the marketing of it. Like, mm-hmm. things like an Armando show where there's a story, then the audience is connected to that story,
mm-hmm.
And potentially the storyteller, and then they watch the improv based on it, so they can see some of, like, they see how the clock works, you know? Mm-hmm. They're like, I see how those 2 things came together.
Mm-hmm.
And because they feel like they're in on it, they're smart. Like a lot of my sketch writing, whenever I will teach people sketch writing, it's a lot of like, make the audience feel like they're real smart.
Mm-hmm.
Even if at the end you pull out the rug, it's like you have to get them on your side, and then they're like, oh, I'm interested. What is happening? Like,
mm-hmm.
and they're either offended, angry, or they're surprised in a pleasant way.
Mm-hmm.
But there's always some sort of rug being pulled out. But with improv, you can't like organize that exactly as well. So I feel like certain shows, like one of the shows that recently came out that I thought really did well to market it and get people interested in improv was Penalty Box.
I thought that show
was just such a smart way to get the audience super involved,
mm-hmm.
in what's going on in the scenes. The idea that they know something that the performers don't is this little gem of magic that is such a smart thing,
mm-hmm.
to have, because then the whole audience thinks they are the funniest people in the whole wide world because they have it over on this guy over here,
mm-hmm.
and he doesn't know what he's doing and he's frustrated, you know, and it's like, yes.
Well, that's why I think, in my opinion, suggestion taking is important, because even if it's just one word that the audience is contributing to a show,
mm-hmm.
It's what makes them feel like they're a part of it, and it makes them feel like there's a rule they've put that they at least understand.
Because,
mm-hmm. like, as improvisers, we can do a formatless show, but there's still rules we know. We know to say yes, we know how to support, we know how to add, we know how many variables or too many variables that we're throwing in. But sometimes the audience has no clue what's going on. And so I love formats that give them an idea of what's going to happen, because then at least they can follow along a little bit better.
Yeah.
And again, this is a left brain person speaking, so there's probably half the world is right brained, and I'm sure they're all fine with no rules improv shows, but I personally need to know kind of what to expect to be able to enjoy it.
I actually feel like a lot of people are like that, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I've received any information from audiences, it's often that they, you know, feel sort of left out. Like that something is happening and they're just not quite part of it. And so I don't think it's just you or even just left brain mm-hmm. people. I think it's, especially too, in the world we live in, the entertainment we have at our fingertips, like, we're able to choose what we want. So if we've chosen to sit in this room with everyone, mm-hmm. they want it. They want something. There's an expectation. Mm-hmm. So I just think it's, sometimes I think it's a matter of marketing. And then sometimes I think it's a matter of like framing a show, giving it a theme or something. Mm-hmm. Like I like the ones where, what was it? I believe it's, I just talked to Tyler Lane about Channel 2, and they were talking about how they do like a genre. So their suggestion is based on a genre, but the genres aren't just like, hey, give me a genre. They each come up with one and then kind of pitch it, mm-hmm. and then the audience picks one of the pitches, which is an excellent way to control mm-hmm. what's going to happen, because that way... And I would definitely not suggest in any way like pre-planning what you're going to do for each pitched genre, but mm-hmm. it certainly helps not have like a horrible, weird, creepy thing that an audience member may have said thinking they're hilarious mm-hmm. and really like they've now backed you into a corner of like pimps and hoes or something, or like, right. or like some weird, like you're like, okay, no, thank you. Right. Like it'd be like, let's try something that's not going to be deeply offensive, because there's a lot of weird things people can say. Mm-hmm. So to help hone what they can receive the suggestion can certainly help.
Well, and I actually took a lot of classes over at Hideout. I graduated their program, and I'm still pretty active over there, and I love their narrative style, and they're very big on having some genres selected ahead of time, or maybe a theme, and I actually have a troupe, Soundstage 23, we're a musical improv troupe, and we usually come in with some kind of genre or theme in hand, but we ask the audience for the title of a movie that they've never seen. And so on one hand, for me, coming from New Movement, where you are taught to have zero suggestion going into it, you make everything up the second you're on stage, which is improv, but having that element of that genre, it's kind of nice, because it gets you guys all on the same page to where you can almost be more open and confident in just letting yourself go and letting whatever comes out of your mouth come out, because you know you're already on the same page with at least one thing. And then having that title of the movie is fun, because it really gives the audience a way to be a part of it. And then you can take and interpret that thing however you want. And we've had some real wonky... We did a nun show musical once. We did Harry Potter, an improvised Harry Potter show. We've done Christmas themes. I mean, we've done so much fun stuff.
How do you like the narrative? Because years ago, I had a musical improv troupe called Water Park, and we tried to do narrative shows, though none of us were trained at the Hideout, though we probably should have been, trying to find a way into story. We always had a problem with, like, the end, like, wrapping it up. Mm-hmm. You don't have to talk about wrapping it up, but with reference to doing narrative improv, how do you find the journey is? Is it easier for you? Are there things you've learned that have helped you get around the bumps?
Yeah, you know, I find narrative extremely difficult. And again, I really like UCB style. I'm naturally more of a game player. But when I first started narrative, I hated it. I never wanted to take another narrative class, and I swore I was just going to do it to get through Hideout. But by the end of that narrative class and actually doing some narrative shows, I really came to love it. And I find that musical narratives are actually a little bit easier, because you can travel pretty far in a song that you can't do without the music. So, yeah. Like, for example, the middle of that show, a 30-minute narrative, that's hard to do. I mean, you got to display a want, you got to set the scene, you got to have something go wrong, you got to see that person dealing with wrongdoings, they've got to suddenly find a way to be right, save everyone, wrap it up, maybe have a kiss.
Yeah.
And in 30 minutes, that's a lot. And it's nice to have those songs in there to be able to have kind of a traveling montage of watching that person, you know, get beat up and then get back up and find the girl, save the girl, all in one song.
Yeah.
But non-musical narratives, I still think are extremely challenging. But I think when you do a good one, it's so rewarding.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you can make it happen in a truly improv way, it's like, oh, I've just touched God. Like,
yeah,
because it's like stories are unreal to create this unreal thing, because the narrative, we all like to imagine that our own lives are a narrative, but really they're not. Like, they're our own narrative, but we don't know. There's no wrap up ending in our own lives in the same way that, like, we want television and movies and improv scenes to be like, oh, I feel complete, there's a bow. So, man, if you can really get that.
Oh, it's so rewarding.
It is like.
Well, and that's why I love The Herald, too. So, like, montage, to me, a montage show is the funnest show, but it's the least gratifying, because at the end you just did a bunch of shit. Maybe it wrapped up, maybe it didn't.
Yeah.
And again, I haven't really done good montages, clearly. but that's one of the reasons I love The Herald, is because The Herald's challenging, but in theory it should all wrap up in the end and have some kind of closure where suddenly all these worlds and scenes are kind of coming together at the very top and or at the very end, and I love that.
Yeah, I like it too, but just because my, like, initial obsession with comedy came through sitcoms, and I believe the Herald format is used a lot of times in sitcoms.
Yeah, isn't it Always Sunny? I was told that was a Herald format.
So. I believe so. I don't watch It's Always Sunny, so I can't speak to it. But, like, Seinfeld is.
Is it? Is Curb, too? Curb Your Enthusiasm?
I believe so. I mean, they're written pretty much the same way, so. But, yeah, if you watch, like, with Seinfeld, the reason why there's four characters is because three of them are the path and one of them is the game. And usually Kramer's the game. Like, so you just follow along. They each do weird shit. We meet back in the house. They talk about it. We go back out. We do more weird shit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's very. But even though it's, like, as simple as just going on a date and that's the beat. But, I mean, that's why I love Harold, because it makes people feel like they're gonna create an insane amount of things when really it can be so manageable. I'm such a structure person. Like, so I really appreciate, like, what you're saying about, like, how Harold is more satisfying than montage. I like montage in an educational way. I feel like it is excellent for throwing stuff against the wall and trying to make it work and not worrying about where it starts or where it ends, like just being sort of free and easy about it. But man, when I'm creating stuff, I am total structure. I mean, everything I've ever done, I've like read up on and then found something that matched the setup and then, built the structure from that. Like, sometimes I'll read books on structure, but I have a hard time getting through those books. So instead, I just find something I like and then put it down on paper. Like, I'll get a script. Like, I taught myself how to write a screenplay by finding a copy of a screenplay that I liked and then just reading it and taking notes about what was happening.
Oh, wow.
And then I bought a structure book because apparently that's a big deal. And I wanted to have a reference book to be like, oh crap, this is happening. Well, how do I notate it? And it's like three tabs. And then, you know, it's like, what the hell? But they're very particular.
That's funny.
But yeah, for me, it's like, I love the structure. If I can understand and wrap my mind around it, like myself, it's almost like, for me, I learned more about improv teaching it than I have performing it.
You know what? That is so true. I haven't done a ton of teaching. I've done a little bit of directing, but just naturally by, you know, I've graduated a bunch of the programs here in Austin, and I find that I'm in a troupe that's associated with each theater, and I like to, like, bring little tidbits of knowledge that I've learned at other theaters in, and I found that by kind of focusing on being decent at those things, since I'm encouraging others in the troupe to try it out too, I've gotten much better at it just by teaching it to others. Or you know what else I learn a lot from is watching people get taught. I've been stage managing a show at Hideout right now called Orphans. It's an improvised orphan musical, and it's amazing.
Fun.
And it's full of, you know, 20 of my favorite improvisers at that theater. And watching them do what I see as perfect improv and then receive notes on it from the directors has been such a great learning experience. Because you almost see you know, when you're an improviser like me that's been doing this maybe 3 years, you're good enough to do stuff, but you're not good enough to be receiving the higher level notes and understanding of why you've learned certain rudimentary habits. Mm. And seeing some of these higher level improvisers receiving notes on their already high level improv has helped me understand, like, oh, that's why they made that rule in level 3. Oh, like, that's why I want to move in factions with groups of people instead of have us all linearly trying to make a 7-person scene make sense. In fact, that was actually, I would say, the coolest thing I've learned this year is I always struggled in big troops. You know, if there's 6 people on stage, really hard to manage that. And it's really hard to know what other people are thinking on stage. And just the other day at Hideout, they were teaching about factions, how, you know, get into 2 or 3 perspectives by clumping together and holding the same perspective as your little group. And that, to me, I mean, that might sound so simple, but that was mind-blowing to me.
No, that's one of my favorite rules ever.
Oh, my gosh.
I actually am, they're lovely to offer 3. When I teach level 1, I say 2 points of view and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to hear more than 2 points of view. Somebody walks in and says, I like cookies, and the second person says, I don't like cookies. The scene's about how you like or you just like cookies. That's all the scene's about.
Mm-hmm.
Like, have crazy opinions about that particular weird singular opinion, mm-hmm. but don't be the third one who's like, I don't know, I could be convinced. Mm-hmm. No one cares. It's too much.
Well, I'm in monopop troupe, so that's my new favorite form.
Yeah, tell me about that. I've heard people referring to this, so I don't know exactly what it is. What's a monopop?
It's great. We do it in my troupe's called Garage. We're every Wednesday at 8 over at 616 Lavaca. Mm-hmm. And it's basically, we do about a 25-minute mono scene, but the difference is whenever something fun or funny or just something you want to see comes up in a conversation between whatever characters on stage, we will wave them off and we want to see whatever that thing was. So if someone says, you know, don't you remember what used to happen, you know, at work back when you worked at Enron? And immediately if someone heard that, we'd go straight to Enron and see, you know, 5 to 10 line scene of what that was like. And it can be so fun. It reminds me a lot of Family Guy, actually.
Yeah.
Those cutbacks, flash twos. And to me, that's fun. Because I like the groundedness of having a mono scene, but I like the creativity and punchiness of being able to cut to whatever the heck you want to see.
Yeah.
And blend any kind of devices you want to see. Scene painting, wave offs, or even like we've had God voice come in. God has made a couple of guest appearances in our shows, sure. Which is really fun.
How did you guys come to that? Did you have a coach that suggested it, or did you guys come in together and say, this is a style we want to do together?
No, so Yamina actually came up with it back when she was artistic director there, and she really wanted to have an all-women mono scene troupe or monopop troupe. And so she put it together, she casted it, there were auditions. And we had our first show, I think, last June or May, and we've gone every Wednesday since then. And it's been fun to watch the progress. We really didn't have a ton of rehearsals, so when you get, you know, 7 or 8 women on a stage together, it can be a little bit hard to figure out how to manage that many people on one small stage, but I'd say, as of a couple months ago, I think we've really nailed it.
Yeah.
On how to manage that.
Yeah, group scenes can be the hardest, like when you feel like you have a larger group, but I feel like it's better to have more people available versus fewer, because
mm-hmm.
I've had a lot of I'm not going to say sad, because I loved my tiny little level ones, but I've had classes that have whittled down to like 4 or 5,
mm-hmm.
like just in the last few classes, like where it's like too late to cancel,
mm-hmm.
like though I have had one recently where it was like on the second to last class 2 people quit, leaving 2 left, and I was
no.
I'm terribly sorry, we are not going to keep going with this class with 2 people only.
No.
But years
Even
ago...
Even though they'd already paid for it and everything?
I mean, there just wasn't anything to do.
Oh.
The people that were... it was like 2 people who, if they did a show by themselves,
right.
it would have been a very unusual sort of situation.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. No, it was all a little weird and, yeah. It can be difficult. I think people got refunds, honestly. I mean, it was only like 1 class, but I think 1 guy asked for it, so he was like, okay.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like... It's so hard to do it with too few people.
Right.
Like, because you want them to be able to experience... It's also real scary. And so to have only 2 people means mm-hmm. that you're holding all of the weight.
Right. Oh, gosh,
you're
I'm
in
still...
every scene, doing everything. You have to edit from within, and which is a tough thing for noobs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't like to make them do... They'll ask me, can I do it? And I go, you can, but... keep in mind it's real hard to do. Mm-hmm. Like, you need to be, you need to understand how to have your brain inside the scene and outside the scene at the same time. And I just don't know that level one's the time when you're developing that skill.
Gosh, I mean, I'll edit from inside a scene, but I'm still scared to do duo improv. I mean, I've done a few, but I don't know what it is about that is just so difficult.
I think it's like, you know, it's nice to, like I said, it's nice to have other people around in mm-hmm. case, because I don't think either you or myself or most of the people we know are very scared individuals, but I've 100% been on the side of the stage and then just been like, I literally have no ideas. My brain isn't empty. Right. I have nothing. And in those moments, I'll try to push myself. Like, it's like, if I get a blank slate brain, I go, oh, it's time to go in.
Yep.
Because it's like, who knows what I'll say.
Right.
Like, it could be horrifying, but I'm trying.
I'm going to do my best. Yeah. And, you know, I personally like playing support roles more than main roles, which is kind of interesting because I'm an introvert that appears as an extrovert. But for whatever reason, I never want to be a protagonist in my narrative stuff. I never really want to initiate the first scenes or even some of our monopop shows. I've had entire shows where I never actually was one of the key players on the stage. Mm-hmm. I just did occasional wave-offs and cut-tos, and I liked the ability to be able to do that.
I think it's such an important role to have mm-hmm. because I feel like, unfortunately, a lot of times people are, you know, trying to get their 10 minutes. They're like, look right. at me. I'm so great. I'm the best. And, I mean, those people don't often spend a lot of time in improv, to be honest. But, like, there are certainly people who will enjoy their time being the lead players and never allow to be a supporting person, you know. And in the less toxic version of that, it's nice to have a partner in your team that will be the side player. I mean, mm-hmm. I love doing support roles. If people would let me, I would do it. People never let me.
You're so good.
No, it's because when you've been around long enough that most of the people that you're in any jam with, you've taught more than half of them, mm-hmm. like, they defer to you. Like, right. I actually asked Nathan how it felt because I knew it was going to happen to him once he became the conservatory director. Mm-hmm. I was like, what's it like to do scenes now? Do they talk or do they stare at you until you say something? Because that's what they do. Like, every scene I'm in forever, anytime, people, I walk on and then people just look at me and wait. Mm-hmm. And I'm all like, all right, I guess I'll have the first line. But usually I like to be like, hey, I don't know. Who knows what part I can play? I can be here for you. What do you got? What do you mm-hmm. got? But, you know, people oftentimes just, and Nathan said they did it to him too. Like, after a while, when a lot of the people in the jam were students that he had taught, mm-hmm. they would walk onto a scene with him and just defer to whatever he wanted. And it was like, no, man, embrace it. Take whatever you want. I wanted to give you the power.
I still get like that with Nathan. Like, there's even Lisa. I'm in a weekly troupe with her. I've been performing with her for 8 months now, and for whatever reason, improv is a funny world where, like, if someone's had a year more of experience than me, they're God and I can't touch them, so I should just kind of bow down. And recently I've finally gotten the confidence to just say fuck it. Like, if they don't like something I do, that's fine. But yeah, in fact, I think I've recently played in a jam with Nathan where I kind of looked at him like, go ahead, tell me what to do.
I feel about different levels of experience in a troupe the way a couple months ago I worked an event at the theater that was not a theater event. It was tech companies got together to have a discussion on diversity. Hmm. And I just happened to be the house manager that day. Mm-hmm. And they were engaging. So I sat in on their talk. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was super interesting that one of the things that they were trying to say was, we need to put diversity in every workplace, but we don't need to put it in a way that is forced, like, these people, we need to make sure everybody's got a job, so much as let's talk about it in a real, we all have different ways of looking at the world. Mm-hmm. We have had different levels of experience in the job that we do, and we've come from different backgrounds. when we're working on a project together, we need those people mm-hmm. of all different points of view so that they can both represent the part of the consumer base that they represent, and also so that wherever they learned, whatever school they went to, jobs they had before, they can bring in their knowledge from that. Same with improv troupes, people of different levels and from different places. I think it's so important because it's like we're all receiving the information in different ways. We've all taken different levels. Mm-hmm. The people that taught us were different than, you know, what how it works out. The experiences we've had on the stage in other venues mm-hmm. all brings to stage this perfect little thing. Mm-hmm. And I just think it's so necessary to have different ways of looking at it, in the same way that in this diversity seminar they were saying people of diverse backgrounds need to be in a workplace. I was like, yeah, totally. Absolutely. And it was a perfect way to describe how you can put something together.
Right. Well, in improv, it's so important to have diversity, but then I also do find value in, like, watching the same improv together and doing, like, seeing and doing the same improv to get on the same page. Because just, I've found that when I improvise, let's say, with people from all different theaters, like, some of the worst jams I've done have been people from all different backgrounds together using their personal techniques and styles, and mm-hmm. it just doesn't mesh. But then when you're able to get those people together, like Channel 2, and they spend time together, they get to know each other, they kind of watch some of the same shows together, and once they're on that same page, it's the most beautiful work of art on a stage I've seen.
Oh, yeah.
Channel 2 is a great example of that. Anyone listening to this needs to go watch them.
Absolutely. Yeah, they're very fun. But, I mean, I feel like that's almost the... in the example of the diversity thing, seminar that they were like, yeah, it is going to be hard that first time. Mm-hmm. The first time it's going to feel real clunky. And you're right, in a jam where it's a bunch of strangers that haven't worked together, but every job, every, you know, team, whether it's at a tech company or an improv troupe, are people who over time get mm-hmm. to know each other, can use their skills. I mean, we can't, if I met somebody for 20 minutes, I can't really use every skill that I truly have because I don't know what's necessary for our conversation. I don't know, you know. I pick and choose based on how I feel like it works in the moment. Mm-hmm. And if I do a jam and I think a bunch of people are going to defer to me, I try to give them scenes they want to do.
Right.
Like, that's another part of teaching that I think is really important. I use level one to make people less scared of putting their ideas out there, no mm-hmm. matter what those ideas are. And so part of what I do is I make their job not just to say stuff out of their mouths, but also to pay attention to the other people. Mm-hmm. And not only do I say it's really important for you to know each other person in this room because someday you're going to be in a scene with them, and if you know he loves making sci-fi references, you know what to tell him to get him really interested immediately in the scene. Or mm-hmm. if this person constantly plays, you know, animal characters, you know you can swing right in and you know they like that, so they're going to, you know, see what choices they make on their own. Mm-hmm. And then that's what you know of them, you can give them what they like. And I use it so that they're not focusing on themselves. Mm-hmm. So that they're not going, oh God, what am I going to say? How's it going to go? Instead, I say, look at the person you're in a scene with. What do they want? Mm-hmm. And then hopefully that allows them to reflect it on the other person and feel like they're helping somebody versus like, I'm the coolest, or, oh my God, everything I say is stupid.
Right.
So,
well, and just being okay with, like, I'm the worst with pop culture references. I mean, the worst. I mean, I'm so embarrassed. There are people who will name presidents that I'm like, who was that? Was that a rapper? When Dr. Ford, was that? But just being okay with A, not knowing, and B, just being an expert on the fucking thing. Yeah, of course. Mr. Ford, he wrote War and Peace. Yeah.
Yeah.
Met him personally.
Yeah.
And just, you know, that's a fun scene. You look like an asshole, but the audience loves that.
Yeah.
And that was hard for me because I consider myself by nature a perfectionist, which is really difficult to do with improv when you're dealing with so many things out of your control. But I've learned that I'm comfortable improvising when I'm okay with just saying whatever comes out of my mouth and just defending it. Absolutely. I'm an expert in everything out of my mouth. Gosh, I was once in a show where I had to, I'm trying to remember, I had to narrate, I think it was this, oh no, I'm going to sound like an asshole even trying to remember what the name of it was. It was like the Spanish Inquisition. And of course, that's like a word I remember from seventh grade. But outside of that, I don't know, a bunch of Spaniards that were curious. I
don't know. Had a lot of questions. They were inquiries.
They were collaborating with the French, I'm sure.
Sure. Collaborations all over history.
Exactly. But then we ended up having a really great improv scene that came from the Spanish collaborating with the French.
I love to take words that people think mean one thing for sure and change it totally.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, those are the most fun.
You know what I find also really funny but frustrating is accents in improv. I don't know what it is. I am a Jewish girl. I come from a loud Jewish family. I've listened to loud Jewish mothers nagging constantly. And the second I need to use that that accent that's in my pocket, like German comes out or Swedish. It's like I can't do it. And then you get home in the car and you're like, where the hell was that? But the audience eats it up. I mean, I had to do an improvised stand-up routine as Elmer Fudd a couple weeks ago, and I didn't remember what he sounded like. So I just picked a name. I picked a stutter and just committed to it. And in no way is that Elmer Fudd in any way, shape, or form. And I then did a 10-minute stand-up routine as a fucked-up Elmer Fudd, and the audience loved it. But I've also had plenty of faileds by that logic as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, sometimes they're with you and sometimes they're not. Yeah. I think sometimes if you just try, then the audience will be happy to have your back in that moment. Yeah. Usually it's like I try to use a little bit of the like, you like me, right? Come on.
Yeah.
I'm horrible with accents, though. My husband makes fun of me so much. We were watching a television show the other day where there was a character that was Jamaican, and that person on the screen was doing a proper Jamaican accent. And my husband goes, oh, that sounds like your Irish accent. And I was like, yeah, thanks.
Let's hear it.
I swear. It's so bad. I start with, like, I always go, like, don't you know? And I'm like, nope, that's Minnesota. And I'm like, oh, I'm getting the... Oh, I can't even do it.
Yeah, it's like some geriatric. The Shire. Sort of,
it gets horrible. I end up moving, it's like Minnesota to Irish to Jamaican.
But you know what? It lands for people like me who don't know pop culture or any references. So to me, I'm like, that sounds like a great Jamaican accent. I don't know why people are scoffing.
But it's like you were talking, too, about, like, the accents you have in your back pocket. I grew up in Boston. You'd think that I'd have a good Boston accent. I can't do it. I end up doing the horrible Kennedy one. The Kennedy one's wrong. No one sounds like the Kennedys. Only the Kennedys sound like the Kennedys. No one else sounds like them.
I'm trying to think of what an actual Bostonite sounds like.
To think.
Oh no, I'm putting you under the pressure.
No,
again.
It's like if you took a lot of drugs and then your tongue was like, I remember when I got my wisdom teeth taken out, my accent was very strong. And I was like, oh, it's back.
It packed the car, right?
That's it. That's what everyone says, pack the car. How they do it. But usually I try to get into it with you like these apples? You know, that's my if you wanna jump right in. Or you think you better than me? There you go.
That was good.
There you go. You think you better than me? See, that's the number one.
You don't have time to workshop this in an improv scene, unfortunately.
Yeah, see? So, no, yeah. And I'm not confident in it. If I were confident just to jump in it, sure. I need to take a class in it because they say you can come up with like a touchstone phrase and that'll just like make you go into it.
Get
like,
it going.
You can use that and just say that one line and then it'll just bloop, and then you're just in the accent. If you, you know, exercise that part of your brain. I suppose it's like anything.
Yeah, I actually downloaded an app. I was at a UCB show a couple years ago in New York, and I was so impressed with how these guys were able to pull these accents out of their pants. And I downloaded an app on my phone that is supposed to teach you different dialects. And so I tried to spend about a week learning how to speak like a proper Boston accent and New Yorker, and like to differentiate how to speak like people from London. And then after about a week and a half of spending probably 100 hours on this, I realized that it was not going to be a returning investment for my improv because I got no better. And on top of that, I am not an improviser who's here to get better to make this a career. I just do this for fun.
Yeah.
So I aborted that real quick.
I feel like that app would work really well for, like, actors who have to do a specific role.
Well, you'd say over and over, you say, like pack the car. And so I found myself walking around, like, I'd just walk around New York, just pack the car, pack the car. And I probably look like a total psycho. I don't know. Actually, maybe not in New York.
Very regular. Yeah,
pack the car,
car. This makes sense. Yeah. That person needs to remember to park the car is what they were saying to themselves. What a logical thing to do. Yeah, they just thought you were the smartest. They're like, oh, I should do that.
Good. Hey, buy, thanks,
groceries.
Man.
Buy groceries. Yeah. You start a whole thing.
Oh,
yeah. So with reference to, you mentioned a second ago that you just do improv as a hobby. Mm-hmm. How did you, I know that you got into it through the Groupon, but like, since you've maintained your career, and that's real estate, correct?
Yes.
How has doing the improv helped you? And then also, do you think, have you spoken to other people in the industry and said like, oh, you have to do this? Or is it really more of a you personally find it enriching in a way that helps you or doesn't help you? Who knows?
Oh, I mean, hands down, it has been helpful for me in life, in my attitude, in my sanity, and definitely my business. I recommend improv to anybody that, well, really anybody.
Yeah.
But I found it's been really helpful in, you know, being able to sit down with clients I've never met. I used to be really nervous. Like, a lunch one-on-one with someone I don't know couldn't be, there's nothing that's more terrifying than that. And I found that through doing improv, you learn, like, well, what's the worst that's going to happen? No one's going to die if this is an awkward lunch. And, you know, I've done enough 60-minute improv shows to know what an awkward silence on stage feels like.
Yeah.
So now I'm able to go into those more confidently and even just speak with confidence. And things come up sometimes that I don't know. I consider myself an expert at this point in real estate, but there are still things that come up that I don't know, and I'm able to mask that a little bit more now.
Sure.
But
give you the time to look it up.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and I've also found that real estate's an industry where you don't have a whole lot of work-life balance. It's more a work-life blend. Yeah. And improv has helped me stay sane through that because there isn't anything, not working out, not even sleeping before bed. I'm checking email all night. Even sometimes I wake up at night to check my email.
Mm-hmm.
And improv is the one thing that I'm able to put my phone down and just exist in a totally meditative state.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is.
No, I feel like it's the one, it's one of the things, like live performances, if you really let yourself both as the performer and then as the audience, if you really just try to exist in the moment,
mm-hmm,
with the people and the whole thing, with your phone down,
mm-hmm,
I think that that's something that we crave because, mm-hmm, we don't have it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why there's a part of me that really thinks that, and maybe I'm kidding myself, but that there will be a bit of a resurgence to live performance and live theater, even music, you know, like going to see bands and being physically in a room with them, like, mm-hmm, and not in a humongous scenario, which is different,
mm-hmm,
but in a, like, whoa, they're, I can see them, they're close to me, like Stubbs, where it's like, even the furthest you can be from them, you're still pretty close.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, there's something about being in a room with a bunch of other people that are experiencing the same thing that you are. With music, you know, you can sing along, so there's that. But with live theater, you know, you all get to go through this emotional, visceral thing, whether it be, in our case, providing them with laughter,
mm-hmm,
or a mutual awkward experience, or you know, in other theater where it's like they get to experience sadness, and we have movies and we have TV for a lot of that, you know, to go through. And I feel like the binge world of it has gotten us a little bit more in the journey of a, mm-hmm, show. Like, I'll binge two or three seasons of a serious television show because now I get to really feel the journey of the writing and, like, oh wow, I didn't realize that in the end of the third season you learned at the beginning. Same with a theater.
Mm-hmm.
You're in the room, you're with them at the beginning of their journey, you're with them through the end of their journey,
mm-hmm,
and you can really, like, feel it and be part of it with these other people. Then you can leave and go, hey, what did you guys think? You were also here in this moment.
Right.
I feel like the internet and a lot of the technological stuff that we have has separated us. And so we're all searching for how to connect with each other. And hopefully we'll find that in live performance.
And with, you know, with TV, there's less of a commitment to it, too, because you can always just rewind it now. And I've found that being in an improv show, I love it because, number one, it's never going to happen again. And it's pretty rare that they're recorded, so you really won't have a chance to see it again. And you can't rewind it, so you really have to be paying attention. And there really, other than work, isn't anything that gets my hyper attention like that. They're really, even my poor husband, I don't even focus on anything he says like I do on an improv show, which I should work on. That's another conversation we've had to have. Is,
sure.
You know, I got to cut back on improv and make a little time for my sweet little hubby. But even that shit's hard. Because then you get home and there's the TV.
Yeah, it can be difficult, especially in a relationship where, like, mostly the time that you see each other is when you're sort of relaxing from stuff.
Yeah.
My husband has been traveling a lot for work.
Mm-hmm.
So the only time he's home, he doesn't really want to have the tough conversations. Like, things like, hey, we need to fix the dishwasher. Or, like, you know, we need to buy a blank because this broke or whatever.
Right.
I don't know. Believe me, I'm usually the one like, the water, I'll fix it.
Hey, that's been coming out for a while.
You've been gone for a week and a half and now the water doesn't work. Why?
I'm a notorious toilet paper forgetter. I mean, I probably once a week have to ask my husband if I can have his toilet paper. It's bad. But actually, my husband is, I don't know about yours, but mine comes to most of my improv, so I'm so grateful for for us. That's like the most substantive conversation we have most nights is like talking about my show, which sounds so self-indulging.
I don't know. I mean, part of me feels like it's a little, if you were trying to be, you know, Amy Schumer, then sure, it might be a little self-indulgent if the only conversation you're having with your husband is about this thing, but it's almost like you went to therapy and then you went home and talked about your therapy. I feel like that's okay.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You're not dealing with it in a way that is like ego and, you know, you're like working through how do I communicate with a human being. And
he's my best source of feedback. That's actually the most beautiful thing is he will say honestly.
Oh, that's great.
When I've talked too much or, you know, if something I said, like why he felt like it didn't resonate with the audience, which I really enjoy. I also love, I rewatch my shows whenever possible. I try to film them. Hideout has Twitch up so you can kind of live stream it. And I will watch those over and over and over and then kind of come up with questions and then ask Ian about them and get his feedback. And
that's great that he comes and sees all your shows.
Yeah.
I'm going to be honest, my husband hasn't been to see a show that I've done in years.
You've been doing it for so long, though.
How long I have been doing it for a long time. I mean, I've done, I did, I've been in Austin doing improv for 9 years.
Uh-huh.
And then I've been doing The Neighborhood for 8 years.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize it was that long.
Yeah. I, like, took a class in sketch and then was like, oh, I want a sketch show now. Though I always wanted to do SNL.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes total sense that a sort of SNL-esque thing would be what happens.
Mm-hmm. Y'all did that show recently over the Hideout the other week. How did that go? I've always found it interesting when sometimes a show that hits at one theater, when you do it in front of a different crowd, sometimes there's a different response. So I was curious.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. There was a certain amount of like, oh, this is a different kind of audience. So, like, we have a second month there in March. And so because of that, we are writing in a slightly different way for the new show now that we've felt the Hideout audience. But sketch comedy is sketch comedy. And I try to make sure that whatever we write could work in any space. Because, you know, the hexagonal stage there at Lavaca is so like difficult to manage if you're not used to it. So when we get super used to it and then we went to the Hideout, which was very proscenium, it's like, okay, guys, we got to make sure that we're all turning this way. We got to know facing us. Like, you have to have that awkward, I'm facing the audience and talking to the person next to me. It's just totally fine. Just do that.
Uh-huh.
Like, so little things like that. Or, like, where do we put our props in this one on the sides? Like, mm-hmm. just little things of how to manage that kind of stuff are fun to figure out. Especially with a new group. Like, the group that I have right now has only been, there's a bunch of people that are new. So they're everyone's kind of learning each other right now. Mm-hmm. So the change is fun for them because I can say, okay, guys, something crazy's happening. This is what's going on. We're moving to this place. Like, and they were cool with it. And I was happy to make the connection with, you know, the hideout and the people over there. I mm-hmm. think that they're wonderful. And I was so thankful that they opened the doors to me.
Yeah.
I mean, thankfully, we sold out over there. And I felt really good about it.
Yeah.
Because not only did I want to be able to do the show that I loved, but I also wanted to thank the people that housed me by giving them money.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I was able to sell out the show for them, and it was like, good, great. Yeah. And in fact, the house manager that night was like, I can't believe we have so many shows. And I just thought, I can't believe you don't have this many shows every... Because, I mean, it was packed.
Yeah.
There was a line to go in the downstairs space and the upstairs space, both. Like, and it was wild.
That the Hideout coffee shop is amazing at... Oh. I mean, the programming they do, the marketing they do, the community commitment. I see the same faces constantly at that theater because we all want to support each other and want to see each other's things. And they just put up such great shows that, like, Orphans only runs for a couple months, so you have to go see it in that finite amount of time.
Yeah.
Which I find a lot of value to having, you know, you've got your flagship shows, you've got your one-off experimental shows, but I really love seeing those kind of seasonal shows, the rotating ones that maybe stick around for, you know, 4 to 6 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I like the idea of those, especially too, because it's like, let's explore a topic and then, you know, don't do it enough that we're tired of it, but do it enough that we get to work on the idea and feel good about it. Yeah, no, it's super awesome. Since some weight has been lifted off my shoulders, I think my next move is to take classes over at the Hideout, because I've always felt like held back from that. And, I'm glad I don't anymore. Mm-hmm. So my hope is to join them, because that's been the crowd that's not only been the most welcoming, to me, but also, like, I'm really interested to get in on the narrative improv stuff and to learn styles that I don't totally understand.
Mm-hmm.
Plus it sounds like there's some quality structures.
Yeah. Oh my God. As a left brainer, I can tell you it totally fills that need. I've taken classes at every theater here except for institution. I've just done some shows down there.
Mm-hmm.
And every theater is so different. And I've found that,
yeah.
you know, Hideout was instrumental to me going from just being an okay improviser to being a confident improviser, because they taught a different technique that I never got at the New Movement. And mm-hmm. by putting those two together, I felt like I could kind of deal with whatever was thrown at me.
Yeah.
And then I took classes at Cold Town, and Cold Town was... I really enjoyed their education. They really hit hard on, like, the game and the Herald and yeah. So I have to go over to the institution.
Yeah. Check them out. I think they're, they've got a different kind of style too. A lot of games and stuff like mm-hmm. that.
I believe they do the Annoyance, which is a really interesting, kind of like come up with your shit and stick to it.
Yeah. I mean, it's so funny because I only know a little bit about each one, and I just sort of pick and choose and pull my own theories from it. I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. Sure.
Yeah.
But I don't know that I know the format that they use too often in their shows. I've seen a lot of sketch shows there,
mm-hmm.
or like some stand-up variety stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I've been part of a few variety shows over there.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I think they've hosted some Five Families shows where all five theaters were represented in the shows. So it's a fun spot for them. I really appreciate you sitting down and chatting with me about improv. It's been nice to talk to you, and I appreciate hearing your point of view from somebody who's taken classes at a lot of different places. I think it's important to acknowledge that, you know, there's a breadth of information in the improv world in Austin, and that, you know, being, I personally believe that you get better with each new thing that you learn. Mm-hmm. Like, keep learning, take more classes, go to as many as you can, because the more that you learn, the better you can be. And for me, I want to be a better teacher, so I want to learn as much as I can.
Right.
So, yeah.
When Austin, the Austin community is so beautiful to me, because unlike a lot of cities, you know, like wherever, Cincinnati, wherever you might be, Austin has such a diverse selection of programming that you can go through all the programs and be a top-tier improviser if you just stick to it, versus some other places you have to go to New York to get a game-style improv, you know, education, or you have to go to L.A. to find a narrative, things like that.
Yeah, most smaller cities generally have, like, two theaters, mm-hmm. and they're either doing the same thing, the same sort of UCB Chicago style, or they're, you know, wildly different in a way that it's like, this one's a rejection of everything. And then, you know, yeah, I find that I've been trying to talk to people all around the country to see what kind of improv there is out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, the only city that I've interviewed multiple people in to kind of try to get a larger view of it is Pittsburgh.
Oh, interesting.
So I've interviewed three people, and I have a few more on the docket, just to learn about different styles. And some of them teach at both of the improv schools, and some of them are, I have the founder of one of the improv schools to talk to, just because it's like, every city has their own, in the same way I was talking earlier about how I was trying to research the history of Austin Improv,
mm-hmm.
and I spoke to a bunch of people at the Hideout, because the Hideout was the first one, and to like get down to which people have been around the longest, and then what happened before that, and how much do we know, because the journey from one theater, the Hideout, in the center of town,
mm-hmm.
to five theaters all over the place, mm-hmm. doing all sorts of different things, is a very interesting thing. Like, how did that happen, and why is this city hold it so well?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because when I talk to people in other smaller cities that are the same size as Austin, they'll be like, five? Who are these people? I mean, we got two, and we feel like we're all the same people. Oh, right. You know, and so it's like, yeah, I don't know. I don't know how we all ended up in one spot. I don't know how many...
We all support each other so well. That's what's even cooler, is I think people don't look at each theater necessarily as competition, but we all want the other spaces to exist.
Yeah.
So we can perform at them, learn at them.
We're all trying to make more spaces.
I know, right?
Every time I talk to somebody else, they're like, we're trying to open up this other one. You're like, yep, we do need that. Yeah. That's true.
Yes, absolutely. I have got to be in Pflugerville soon doing improv.
I'll talk to you later about Georgetown. I teach it up there.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Oh, how funny. Yes, tell me later. I'm having all this airspace.
No, you're fine. But yeah, I mean, it's everywhere, and it's beautiful, and thankfully we're in a nice town where everybody's mm-hmm. Sweet to one another.
Yeah.
I appreciate you sitting down with me.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is super fun.
Cool. Well, thank you. Enjoy the rest of your evening, and have fun improvising.
Awesome. You too, Amy. Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast.